Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you do if your spouse was unfaithful, your favorite child was plotting a crime, and what you thought was a simple work assignment seemed to be leading a killer to his victims? These are just some of the problems L.T. McGill carries around with him in his debut as the newest detective in the venerable lineup created by author Walter Mosley. With the demise of the much-loved E.Z. Rollins in 2007's Blonde Faith, Mosley now is embarking on a new series of 10 books with another unlikely but likable hero, a former mob fixer turned private eye. The book is called The Long Fall, the first Leonid McGill mystery, and we are delighted to have Walter Mosley with us to talk about it. Walter, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You have said, and I love this description, that characters are born to you like Athena, springing fully formed from the brain of Zeus. Can you talk about the genesis of L.T. McGill?
Boy, I don't remember saying that. That sounds so, I don't know.
It's very poetic.
Well, it is, but I'm comparing myself to Zeus. I don't like that. But anyway, I don't know how that happened. You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure if I... Characters come to me, and I start to write about them. But, excuse me, this phone is ringing. It shouldn't be. I write about these characters, and they begin. And as time goes on, I start to discover them, and that's really the most of it. When I'm in the 10th book of the Leonid McGill series, I'm sure I'll still be finding out things about that character.
And he started for you as a short story character. When did you realize there was enough here to really base a series around?
Before I was finished with the story.
Really?
I was writing about a story called Karma for a book that Otto Penzler put out called Dangerous Women. And I was halfway through it, and I understood that Leonid, with his relation to his wife and his child and his world, was so extraordinary that it could be a series. At that time, I didn't think I was going to write a series about him, but I was very drawn to him.
Is that one reason that you do short fiction? Is it sort of a study for what might turn out to be a novel?
No. I write short. I like writing short stories. I like writing everything. I write essays, and I write everything but poems. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I don't write poems is they're so bad that they embarrass me so much I can't even think about them.
Does each sort of genre that you write in allow you to express a different creative need?
Well, I think that there are different questions that come up, and different genres can address those questions. And so, for instance, my young adult novel, 47, I wanted to be able to talk to young and older people about slavery in such a way that people would want to read it, that they wouldn't be afraid of it or put off by it, especially black people. And so there's no way I'm going to write a mystery about that. I mean, it just would be too incredibly complex and convoluted. When I wonder about the future and about where we might go, I mean, science fiction, of course, is the thing to do. And if I'm thinking about politics, why try to tie that into a novel? I can just write a book, you know, a nonfiction book about politics.
Do you think black people more than white people or people of other races tend to be sort of put off by the literature that does exist to explore slavery?
Well, I think that when you look at slavery, when anybody looks at their history, they want in some way to be proud and to be happy and to celebrate that history. And the history of slavery is so dark, and we really were such victims in that period that thinking about it only leaves you with sadness and anger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people don't want to live in that particular emotional space.
Well, and it is interesting because it seems that as this country comes to terms with that horrific chapter of its past, maybe the first step is acknowledging everything, only the victimhood, and not even allowing, slave characters to demonstrate other aspects of their personality besides victimization.
Well, I think that has been the way for different people for different reasons. My idea was to talk about the beauty of the life of a single character who was going to outlive slavery by far, and be able to tell the story, which is why it was it was partially fantasy, partially science fiction. Mostly though, it's historical.
So what does L.T. McGill allow you to explore that your other characters in the past didn't so much?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I wrote the Easy Rollins series and the Fearless Jones series, to a great degree, that was paying obeisance to my father and his generation. And even though I was a child of that generation, I was a witness, not a participant. You know, you have Los Angeles and the Deep South, these incredible experiences of black people that haven't entered the literature, not very much anyway. And I wanted to write not about Hollywood and Vine and Sunset, but Central Avenue in Los Angeles, where so much of the culture of Los Angeles blossomed. And so I was writing about my father's era. That era, however, is monolithic in its class and racial structures. It's really a world of black and white. And the world that I live in today is a much, much more complex world, where in order to figure out who you are, you have to figure out where you are at that moment first. Because people, systems, structures all react differently to different people. And so Leonid McGill, for me, is a modern character. He's a 21st century character. And he's, to a great degree, a metaphor for America today. Here's a man who's been living a criminal life for four decades, who's decided to turn it all around and go the other direction. To a great degree, that's where America stands. We've decided to go back against all of these things that we've been doing for the last 40 years.
Yeah, he's so interesting in terms of who he is and who he's trying to become, in that race is still very much on McGill's mind. He's aware of whether or not people are treating him badly because of his race or whether there's some other element to it, even within the first few pages. But it's much more subtle and in some ways harder to understand.
And in the first few pages, he realizes that there's no issue of race at all going on. This woman doesn't like him because she doesn't like the way he looks. She doesn't like the class that she thinks he represents.
He's in a cheap suit.
You know, but she'd be more than happy, you know, to hang out with Lenny Kravitz or vote for Obama. There's no problem for her with that. So it's an interesting notion. And it is much more subtle, and it is much more complex. And certainly the world we live in is not monolithic. It's broken up into thousands of different interests and issues. And Leonid deals with that and is capable of dealing with that in a way that Easy never could, because he didn't live in that world.
And Leonid, in addition to his criminal past, has an interesting personal past. His name is Leonid because his father was a communist.
Yeah, well, his father was the son of sharecroppers who, when they were evicted from their little shanty, a white marshal spit on his mother, the grandfather's mother. Grandfather's name was Clarence. The father's name was Clarence. And he decided he'd become a communist, so he changed his name to Tolstoy. And, of course, that was a mistake. He just thought any Russian name was a communist name because he was so much against America at that time. He became a union organizer, named his kids Leonid and Nikita. And at the age when Leonid is 12 years old, the father goes to fight in some revolution in Central America and never comes back. The mother dies from a broken heart. And here this kid is abandoned by a father with all these ideals, which Leonid rejects. He only keeps the name.
So one thing that I really love about this book is that, for one thing, Leonid's favorite son, Twill, is not only not his flesh and blood, but arguably the most troubled of the three kids.
I don't think he would be troubled. The thing about Twill, or Twilliam, he's a lovable and loving sociopath.
That's not troubled?
Huh?
You don't think of that as troubled?
Well, it's trouble for other people, not for him.
Yeah.
He's not troubled.
Yeah.
He doesn't listen to the rules and the laws of the world that surround him. He follows his own rules and laws, but those are based on his heart, not on some anger or some way of he's trying to get back at people. He just does what he does. He sees the world around him as material, but he's not an evil person in any way. But if he keeps going the way he's going, he's probably going to get killed, and so Leonid has to protect him. But at the same time, Twill takes care of Leonid. This is different than my previous characters, where you have a man who takes in, you know, a son or a daughter or both and tries to raise them and show them how to live right. In this book, the kid gives as much to the father as the father gives to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Leon is clearly has a sort of pride in the natural-born criminal in his son, and yet he wants to make sure, and I love this line, that he survives his own dark brilliance.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly it. He And it's hard because, you know, in many ways, 12, you know, he's 16, 17 years old, he's still a kid.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, McGill is less fond of the son who most resembles him, both physically and in temperament.
Well, I'm not so sure he's less fond of him. I mean, actually, Twill is his favorite because he enjoys him the most. But he loves his other son. It's just that his other son is very taciturn, and he doesn't like Leonid because the anger between Leonid and his wife, Katrina, the son has taken the mother's side, and he's unhappy with his father. He believes that his father is on the wrong and the mother is on the right. Leonid would like to have a better relationship with his son, and in the next novel, he tries very hard to do that, but it's difficult for him. He loves his daughter, Shelley, too. It's just that they don't have anything in common.
Mm-hmm. How much do you know about what will happen to Leonid McGill over the next decade or so of writing?
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. Not everything. Maybe not even half, but quite a bit.
Do you ever think to yourself in the beginning that you know something and then get a few books in and think, what was I thinking? That's not the way it's going to go at all.
No, absolutely. Things change. Mm-hmm. They change drastically. But we'll see how it goes.
Do you like the rewriting and editing process?
I love writing. I get up every day and write. And that's the most pleasurable part of my life.
Do you hear your characters' voices in your heads, particularly when you're writing them in the first person?
No, not at all. But they speak as I'm writing about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so for instance, when I'm writing from a character's voice, things those characters would say, I would never say. I would never even think of saying, except for when I'm writing about them. And so the voice is there, but it's not in my head, which is another thing. You know, I know there's some writers like that they say their characters speak to them and tell them what to do and guide them places, and that doesn't really happen to me.
Are you detached enough that you don't really sort of experience their emotions as you're writing about them?
Sometimes I experience emotion. You know, there's I think it's in Dombey and Son, there's this great line where this old woman is approached by a younger woman, and the old woman seems very hurt, and the younger woman says, Auntie, are you in pain? And Auntie says, there's a pain somewhere in this room. I'm not certain if it's in me.
Hmm.
I think that feeling, which Dickens expressed so well, is somehow what happens to me, that the whole feeling of the scene, of the book, where the book is going, affects me sometimes. But not necessarily the individual characters.
So if what I read is correct, you write every morning. Is that,
yes.
Is that right? Okay. Is there a sort of a ritual that you go through to then separate yourself from that task and get into the rhythm of the rest of your life?
No. It's almost like if you lived on a farm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first thing I do is I milk the cows. When I finish milking the cows, I look out and I see what needs to be done, you know, on the rest of the farm. And whatever that is, that's what I do. It's the same thing. And I get up, I write. When I finish that, I look around and say, well, what's there to do now? Do I need to wash the dishes? Do I need to go have a meeting? What is it?
So are you not consciously thinking about milking the cows when you're washing the dishes?
No.
No.
No. The words used for that question are very important, because most things in art, all art, including writing, are unconscious. And you can't really be conscious of them. So what happens to me, I write 2 or 3 hours in the morning. 21 hours go by. All during that time, the thing I wrote about is going on in the back of my mind, but I'm not thinking about it.
Huh.
But when I sit down to write the next day, things have changed. I've gone further on. I have more to talk about.
Walter Mosley is my guest. His latest book is called The Long Fall, the first Leonid McGill mystery. He'll be in town for a signing tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble on Northwest Highway, across from North Park Mall. You're welcome to join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Walter Mosley. His previous series include the Easy Rollins, Socrates Fortlow, and Fearless Jones Mysteries. His new book is called The Long Fall, the first Leonid McGill mystery. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Walter, people were very sad when Easy Rollins was laid to rest. Have you missed him at all?
No, he's right up on my shelf. Nothing to miss, I tell you.
You don't miss working on him?
No, I don't. I've written over 3,000 pages of first-person narrative from Easy Rollins' point of view. Everything about every aspect, every nook and cranny of Easy's life is covered in that. Mm-hmm. And so I've done that, and it's time to move on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak first to Tyrone in Dallas. Hey, Tyrone.
Hello. Yes, I've read like 14 of your books, and I've read Futureland and Killing Johnny Fry. And they seem to be pretty sexually erotic, and I wonder how you transform from the detective to that style.
Well, I don't know if it's a transformation. It's a different investigation, I guess you could say. I read different kinds of books. I also wrote in the middle of that a young adult novel, 47, which had almost no erotica in it. So eroticism, and so I just write different kinds of books. And what's necessary for that book is what I write.
Your first novel was published when you were in your mid-30s?
Yeah, I was 38.
Was writing something that you always knew that you would do?
No, I didn't start writing until I was 34, and I had no expectation to be a writer until maybe I was 36 or 37.
Wow. What changed at that point?
Nothing. I just wrote a line on hot, sticky days in southern Louisiana, the fire ants swarmed. I wrote that line. I said, hey, that could be a novel.
Uh-huh.
Kind of naively, and went about writing.
In the time since then, have you come to understand why it is that you are a good writer?
Well, I'm not always convinced I'm a good writer. That's one thing. And I think most writers I know feel the same way. And when I am convinced of it, I have no idea why.
I read you said once after you had edited, I think it was Best American Short Stories, you said that good writing and good stories don't necessarily always appear in the same work. And I wonder if you always feel that with the books that you've done, that your work falls to one side or the other of that line in the middle.
You mean good writing or good story?
Yeah.
Well, I hope it's a blend of both, mm-hmm. but that's not actually for me to say. I think it's one of it's easy for a writer, I think, to edit, but I think it's much more difficult for a writer to be a critic of his or her own work. And I try not to be, because it becomes confusing. And as I said before, writing is mostly an unconscious thing. If you get too much, trying to define what it is exactly you are, who you are, how you did that thing, it starts to transcend, leaving that kind of noumenal realm into a more mechanical one.
An email here from Bill in Dallas asks about that conscious versus unconscious question. He says, do you ever capture dialogue or plot elements or things that you might have dreamed for your writing? And how accurate do you feel that your attempts to capture those scenarios has been if you have used dreams?
Well, dreams have never, I write about dreams all the time, but dreams have never informed my writing. Ever.
So you're not, maybe you're thinking about it, but it doesn't yield anything when you wake up the next morning.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's some stuff going on in my unconscious all the time about writing, but it doesn't manifest as dreams.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Walter Mosley is my guest. His new book is called The Long Fall, the first Leonid McGill mystery. Let's go next to Arlington and speak with Sarah. Hey, Sarah.
Hello. This is Sarah Troutman.
Hello.
Hello. I just finished your book this week, and as I was reading it, I was thinking about how it's different in voice and in location than previous books. And it made me wonder about if you're going to write some more science fiction, thinking about that change of pace.
Well, that's interesting that it made you think that. But, yeah, I've actually been writing a lot of science fiction. I've written six science fiction novellas, you know, books between 25 and 30,000 words long that I have kind of put together in an omnibus called the Crosstown Omnibus to Oblivion.
Here's a title for you.
I've been writing. I always write science fiction. I love it doing it. And I can't publish as much as I write, which is kind of a drag. I wish I could, you know, publish, you know, every month. I try very hard to do that, but I am going to be writing. Who knows when they'll come out? Actually, though, with the science fiction, I think starting in September, every 2 weeks on my website, I'm going to put up 1,000 words of this 180,000 word long omnibus.
You're working with a new publisher for this book, is that right?
Oh yeah, Riverhead. I love them.
Yeah. Does it make a difference, the publisher, in terms of the process for you, and how much of a difference does it make?
Well, my publisher it's night and day, and my publisher is day. This new publisher, the things that they're doing for me are extraordinary. You know, I mean, they you know, often I've felt before when I'm writing that I write the book and then I'm supposed to go out and sell the book and I'm doing, you know, all this work and I've never really understood what the publisher's doing. I never understood their plans. This publisher has extraordinary, they're so organized and they plan really, really well. So I feel that everything I'm doing is making sense. And, you know, because, you know, the thing I love the most is writing, you know, running around the country doing reading stuff. It's fun, but it's not my preferred thing. And but the publisher so supports me that, you know, it's great. I mean, I'm 5 days out on a tour. I'm already number 12 on the New York Times bestseller list, which is amazing.
Yeah, I've been surprised to learn from a lot of the authors that we have on this show how much you're expected to do with a lot of publishers in terms of you create the website and you fill it with content. And there's a lot, I guess, required that didn't used to be.
Yeah, and you know, and there's still work that I have to do in those ways, but my publisher really helps me think through everything. And when I come to them, I find that they've been thinking as much as I have, which I just love it. I think it's, the editor is great, the publicity department is great, the marketing, the sales, all of it, which is, you know, it's a very complex business. And Riverhead, I just find they're really good.
I've heard that you've said that you don't believe that writers are teachers or should be teachers. Do you think
That's
that readers
right.
make the mistake of coming to books as students?
Sometimes. And sometimes they come, but I think writers more often make the mistake of coming to their readers as teachers.
Well, you got this bully pulpit,
I'm not blaming the readers so much as I'm blaming the writers. Mm-hmm. A lot of writers think that, you know, they're teaching you things, that you know, they know things that you don't know, and a hierarchy is developed. You know, the writer on top, the reader on bottom. But in the truth, you know, a book, you read a book, that book is as much yours as it is the writer's. You create parts of that book that writer never thought of, and you engage that book. And so therefore, to a great degree, it's your book. And I can't, and so if you came to me and said, well, this is what I got out of your book, I can't say you're wrong, because that's what you got out of the book. That's your experience.
How does what you read play into, if nothing else, that unconscious process by which you're viewing the world and filtering that into the things that you write?
Well, you mean like reading books and things?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because I think that it's, if you meet somebody on the street and they make a statement to you, let's say they make a statement, something I say a lot, they go, the older you are, the more you live in the past. Let's say somebody says that to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's going to have a big impact on you. Well, let's say you read that in a book. Well, it would have the same impact on you. You know, I think that, I mean, I read a lot of things, everything from, you know, from science fiction to comic books to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I love reading that and newspapers and magazines and watching television shows and listening to people on the subway. All of that is equal to me, because the writing itself, the act of writing, is much different than the act of reading.
So do you look at reading as a process of self-discovery?
Reading?
Yeah.
I think life can or cannot be a process of self-discovery. I think you can read and discover nothing. I think you can never read and discover everything. So I'm not, you know, I don't want to make absolute statements about it. You know, I look at, especially what I'm doing, writing novels, things like that, I consider that entertainment. But it's entertainment that causes people to think. It's the thinking about what you're reading and experiencing that makes the difference.
How often do you run into people at, I don't know, cocktail parties or out in public, and they'll tell you, boy, I've always wanted to write a book, but I've never done it?
Very often people express they'll say those words. They often mean different things.
What do you think
like
they
somebody
mean?
Will say, I've always wanted to write a book, but they really mean I always wanted to be a famous writer. I remember I talked to one guy about writing a book, and he said, I realized that the only thing I really wanted was to be rich. And then I realized that writers don't get rich. So he didn't do it. I think some people have a story to tell, and they want to tell that story. And those are the people I'm interested in when they have that conversation.
What do you think is the difference between the people who think that they do want to write, maybe separate from wanting to be rich and famous, and never do anything about it, and the ones who actually sit down and crank that first novel out?
Well, I think that there's some interesting things. Number one, I think a lot of people who read books believe that the writer, that book, as you were saying earlier, comes, you know, fully formed from the writer's mind, and they don't understand the process of writing. And the process of writing is very challenging. And it's challenging in a way because you don't know a lot, that you get to the end of the first draft of a novel and it's bad. Like a lot of people will write a few chapters or something and they'll stop. And I'll say, well, why'd you stop? And say, well, it was terrible. And I said, well, the first draft of any book is terrible because rewriting is writing. The first draft is just, you know, getting it down. The rewriting is what makes the novel.
How many rewrites do you do on a typical novel?
Well, it could be anywhere from 10 to 20 to 30 drafts.
Wow. And do you ever go back and look at draft 10 and think, wait, I want this back?
No, I've never done that. Boy, that would really be a lot of work.
I guess you'd never stop, right, at that point.
Yeah.
My guest is Walter Mosley. His new book is called The Long Fall, the first Leonid McGill mystery. He'll be in town tomorrow for a signing at the Barnes & Noble on Northwest Highway. You can find information about that at barnesandnoble.com. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Lindell in Euless. Hi, Lindell.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two questions, Walter. The first is... your book, The Man in My Basement, is one of the most profound mediations on society and economics that I've ever read. I was wondering what prompted you to write that. That's my first question. And my second question is, my favorite novel of yours is A Red Death, the second in the Easy Rollins series.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could really just take a moment and just really talk about that particular novel and the way you wove in the stories of communism, really socialism, as it relates to the new series about Leonid.
Thanks for your call.
Well, yeah, those are interesting. You know, the Man in My Basement actually came from a joke. Somebody once asked me at a reading somewhere, what do you think the black man in America needs? And I responded rather kind of off the cuff, almost as a joke. Well, what every black man in America needs is a white man locked up in their basement. Because, you know, there's so much about this world that's controlled by white men that we don't understand that we need to go down there and ask them, you know, say, hey, listen, how come I didn't get that promotion? I did the best work. And he answers, well, did you play golf with the guy? You know, that kind of notion. But as soon as, and so it sounded funny at first. I started writing the book, though, and it almost became in verse. Because this guy has somebody locked up in the basement, but really, the guy locked up in the basement is still in charge, and the guy having him there still has so much to learn about life. And so it kind of blended together. And, you know, then I started talking about, you know, power and economics and history and what's hidden from us. And it was that was a lot of fun to write. Leonid McGill, his father was a communist. And a union organizer and a revolutionary, even more so. Leonid is none of those things. He he's been trained by his father, so therefore everything he knows comes from what his father taught him, and you know, from this kind of cockeyed political notion. But Leonid has rejected all of it. In A Red Death, the communist or the socialist character Chaim is an idealist man who believes that peace and equality are the only things that one should work for, no matter what happens, no matter what happens to you. And Easy tries and fails to protect him, not because he agrees with what he's doing, but because he believes in the man's idealism. And that this is a real man, and everybody else is kind of corrupt. So the books are very different in their notions.
Well, it's really interesting, Walter, that you talk about, you know, Leonid obviously has rejected his father's values, and yet the memory of them remains with him even when he doesn't embrace the content of the value.
Well, isn't this true about our relationship with our parents?
Sure.
We love them no matter what. Even if we decide, talking about conscious and unconscious, decide that we hate them and say, I hate you, you still love them. And it's just like a kid, you know, talking to their parents. I hate you, you know. But, you know, they don't.
And I guess it's the same on the other end for parents with their children.
Yeah, exactly.
My guest is Walter Mosley. His new book is called The Long Fall, The First Leonid McGill Mystery. He will be in Dallas tomorrow for a signing at the Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Park. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org or at barnesandnoble.com. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the prolific novelist Walter Mosley. His newest book is called The Long Fall, The First Leonid McGill Mystery. You can see him tomorrow at a signing event at the Barnes & Noble in Dallas on Northwest Highway. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I read an interview, Walter, that you gave in 2000 talking about the election of a president, and you said, well, I can tell you I don't know who he's going to be, but I can tell you that it's a him, that he's white, that he's over 35 and under 60, tall and handsome, speaks well, probably wealthy, straight and married. And obviously that doesn't describe a lot of America, and you were saying that doesn't feel very democratic when you think about how many people fit into that category. Obviously, many of those things are all true about Barack Obama, but not entirely. Have we changed that much in 8 years, or is he such a remarkable individual that we risk assuming that we're sort of over the problem of preordaining who the president might be?
America has been changing a lot, to a great deal because of negative action on the other side. You know, president waging, you know, ridiculous, wars that, you know, that have no basis. A series of four or five presidents that deregulated the economy to such a degree that bureaucrats, not capitalists, took over our business and basically stole everything. That's one thing. And I think that also young America has changed greatly. They have heroes like, you know, for everywhere from Snoop Dogg to Tiger Woods. And certainly, even interestingly, George Bush and his choice of secretaries of state have shown America that different kinds of faces can represent us in very important places. So I think you're putting all those things together. Some things have changed at a certain level. A lot of America hasn't changed at all, which is one of the things about this book, The Long Fall, and the series, where you know, every you know, few minutes you have to gauge, well, where am I, who am I in this situation?
How important is it that non-black Americans might look up to Tiger Woods or Snoop Dogg or Barack Obama every bit as much as African Americans?
Well, one of the things that you see in the history of America is that black people represented nothing of the upper echelons of America in anything. They weren't movie stars, sports heroes, doctors, lawyers, presidents, congressmen or women. They were nothing. They weren't on television except if they were a servant or, you know, a bellhop or something like that. As a rule, the idea that once people of color enter into the culture and represent heroes and people one looks up to for a variety of reasons or relies upon, then that begins to change how America sees those people. I mean, it wasn't exactly a conspiracy, but, you know, people of color, not just black people, didn't appear anywhere. Imagine like a Chinese love interest, you know, in a movie. Before 1975. I mean, ridiculous, you know, in America.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Walter Mosley is my guest. Let's go next to Tim in Fort Worth. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
And, Mr. Mosley, I was curious about your statement that you had made regarding writers shouldn't teach, and I just had never heard that statement before. I don't know how much elaboration you've had on it so far, but I'm working on the certification process of becoming a teacher, but I've been a freelance sports writer, although a not very good one for some time. Maybe that'll make me a better teacher, but I don't know. I just was looking for a little bit of elaboration on your
well,
thought process.
I mean, writers can tell you something, especially if you're doing nonfiction. I mean, you can tell us, yeah, like if I need to know what the scores were last night, or I need to know where this guy, you know, learned his trade. I mean, that's not exactly teaching. It's telling you something. Because teaching basically is actually showing you how to think. Teachers do that. People in schools, they actually work with you. They present something to you. You get it and you respond to it. You make some mistakes and they show you how to do it better. And they continue to go better. I mean, teaching is a very hands-on thing. A lot of you know, writers, you know, believe that they know things, you know, that they can, and that they can pass on to other people. It's only half true. You know something, maybe, and you write it, okay. Somebody else reads it, and they take it from there. Without, you know, without you, you don't go give them a test or a quiz or anything like that. They do with it what they will. You know, we're entertaining to one degree or another, and also we're just giving ideas to people. We're giving them a firmament from which they can grow. But it's their growing, not us.
Well, what's so interesting about that, Walter, is that so many people in school are encouraged to be taught a book. You know, the teacher says, these are the six things that you should take away from Jane Eyre or from something by Mark Twain, and, mm-hmm. and you will be tested on them at the end of the term.
Yeah.
So maybe that's where that all starts.
Yeah, and there's some really bad things with that. I mean, we have two problems with school. One is when education fails, and you have people coming out of school and they can't read and they can't do math and they can't think properly and they don't know their own history. That's when education fails. But when education succeeds, it doesn't do a whole lot better. So what you have is, you know, you'll have a child who says, I want to be a spaceman. I want to climb mountains. I want to go to the bottom of the ocean and see the fishes down there. And, you know, by the time they get out of college, they're saying, well, I hope I can get a good job and, you know, live in a decent house someplace. I think that a lot of our dreams are wrecked by a bad notion of education. And, you know, where, but, you know, the idea of us becoming something. gets lost in, you know, in the needs of, you know, business, basically.
Well, it's interesting, too, that you sort of discovered that you were a writer after you had become something else. You were like a computer programmer or something?
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the greatest things my father ever did for me, and he did many great things for me, but when I asked him, I would ask him, I said, "Dad, what do you want me to be?" And my father would say, "Whatever you want." And I didn't understand it. He said, "Walter, you don't understand. I want you to be whatever you want to be. That's what I want."
And there's a responsibility in that, too, figuring it out for yourself.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next, we go to Frisco and speak with Jane. Hey, Jane.
Hi. My question has to do, Mr. Mosley, with when you first began to write.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about your experience as far as knowing the ropes, as far as the legalities, and for instance, someone just taking your work if you sent it in, and then just using whatever they wanted to and sending it back next, as far as you were concerned. Did you verse yourself really in depth before sending in your first work, or what was your journey like?
Well, to begin with, I mean, there are places where people steal writing. It's mainly in Hollywood. You know, you really should copyright a screenplay before you send it to anybody, because somebody sees a good screenplay that's not copyrighted, they might take it, you know. Novels, no way. Short stories, poems, nobody steals it, ever. Not that I know of. It may have happened at some point or another in history, but it doesn't really happen, and I've never noticed that people don't take your work. You know, in many ways, they don't steal it, and they also don't publish it. That's the problem. You know, it just doesn't happen. There are not a whole bunch of things about legalities. I mean, at some point or another, you need an agent to represent you as far as contracts and you know, with your book, with a publisher is concerned, and that kind of stuff. But there's not a great deal of people taking other people's work.
When the bulk of your work is in prose, how different is the process of writing a screenplay?
Well, screenplay is very different. You know, in a screenplay, you know, in a novel, people say, "Well, show, don't tell." You know, don't tell me what he was feeling. Show me how he felt. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
In a screenplay, they say show. They don't even give you an option for tell. Screenplay is all about what you see. Dialogue is the least important part of screenplays. Most important is how the scenes are structured and what you see on the screen. There's some talk, and the talk means stuff that guides you along, but if it's a good movie, you should be able to turn the volume off and know exactly what's going on.
How do you know that you're getting that done when you're working on the screenplay before it's been produced?
You don't know. You write as well as you can. You give it to somebody. They criticize it, and you know, either they make sense or they don't. That's a toss up.
Do you tend to write a book and then remember almost every detail from it?
No, boy. Sometimes I get embarrassed. I go to readings and people start asking me about some book I wrote, like for instance, A Red Death, which is my the third novel I ever wrote. If you asked me about the details in it, I'd really be hard-pressed.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up, because I imagine, you know, again, sometimes people have just read that a week ago, and it's very fresh for them.
Yeah, and I wrote it 17 years ago, so, you know, who knows?
How often do people come to you with interpretations of your work that, although you want them to think for themselves, just sound nothing like what you ever intended?
Oh, it happens often enough. And I'm happy with people's interpretations. Imagine if you were Shakespeare, and you started listening to people talk about your work today. You have no idea what they were talking about. It's impossible for him to have thought everything that people have written have attributed to him. But, you know, that's okay, because it's not his anymore. It belongs to them.
Do you think about yourself as sort of writing for the ages, or do you think that you're writing things that mean a great deal in the moment and the decade and the century that they're produced?
I don't know if I would say yes to either of those questions. I write stories that I like writing that I hope people like reading. I say things that mean stuff to me. I try to write as well as I can, and I hope that people, you know, different kinds of people will like the work, that either different kinds of people today or in generations to come. But, you know, there's no way to tell those things.
What do you do with the ideas that occur to you when you're thick in the middle of something else? Do you keep a notebook, or do you have scraps of Post-its around?
Once in a while I'll write a note, but it's not too much. You know, there's never a time when I have more than three notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about something going on in the future, some other thing I want to do. I remember I came up with a name one day, Billy Psalms, P-S-A-L-M-S,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, wow, that's a great name. And I wrote it, and I put it on the wall because I wanted to use it one day. And then one day I did, so I was happy.
Are there places that you go to sort of recharge creatively, or things that you do?
No. No, writing is like, you know, it's like eating. Or any other daily activity.
Much harder, though, isn't it?
Hmm?
It's much harder than eating, I mean.
No, I don't think so. I love writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, eating is like problematic. You say, I want to eat. Like, I come home at night and I say, I have to eat. Well, I have to cook before I eat.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, actually, that's harder. I said, well, I have to, okay, now I got to make my Brussels sprouts and broil that steak, you know, like that kind of stuff, you know.
Do you have a hard time understanding writers who you know, for them, it feels like just the most agonizing process? And some writers will tell you they hate writing, but they sort of feel compelled to do it.
Yeah, Joseph Conrad was like that. I don't have a hard time understanding. I believe them. But I don't share that experience. You know, we're different. You know, sometimes I wonder why one would do it if they hate it. But, you know, usually there's some kind of commitment. Some kind of this is a story that needs to be told. I want to get it out there in the world, and yeah, that's fine.
Did this book, which takes place in contemporary times, take a different kind of research or planning than the other ones that you've done that have been set in other periods?
Not really. Because novels today, you know, when you go back and people are writing, somebody like, let's say, Melville, or even, you know, Dickens. You know, the writers from before Conrad or Zola, a lot of that writing was to let you know what's going on in other parts of the world or other parts of your own world. You know, like maybe you live in the north part of Paris. Well, this is what's going on in the south part of Paris. They tell you, they give you a great deal of detail because, you know, there was no magazines, radios, televisions, videos, internet, that kind of stuff. Novels today are very much psychological. They're about character and the development of character. They're about human emotions, specifically more and more distilled. That's not that the earlier novels weren't also about that, but this is a much more distilled version of that.
The latest book by Walter Mosley is called The Long Fall, the first Leonid McGill mystery. Walter, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.